the tech would have his location on the GPS. Moments like this fueled the Watcher, kept him off the drink for long enough to see the mission through. He'd done well, he knew it, and now he would go home and celebrate with a jug of wine, and he would celebrate in the same manner in which he worked. Alone. The call was broadcast over a net that ensured all five kill teams in Paris would hear the news simultaneously. This was a mistake on the tech's part. It all but assured discord among the competitors, did not allow for fallback teams and coverage of escape routes. But the young Brit could not help himself. They'd been a half day without a positive sighting of the target, and it was only an educated guess that he would go to Paris at all. So when the ID came through, he just sent every man with a gun towards his location. He would never admit it to Lloyd or Regal, but since the target had disappeared in Geneva, the tech had been fighting a growing wave of panic. He'd run operations, black operations, wet operations, had overseen logistics of hard assets, but never at any jeopardy to himself. This was the first time his superiors had purposefully set up a scenario where the hunted man, an uber-killer, had known good and goddamn well where the operations control center was and how to get there. The bad guy had been given a golden engraved invitation to come to the tech's physical location, and that was just fucking stupid. Still, the ponytailed man amid the huge table of technology had to admit, it did have the effect of focusing his skills acutely on the matter at hand. The tech had a personal incentive in getting this son of a bitch before he got to the chateau, and for that reason, he'd just broadcast the target's current coordinates as soon as the confirmation had come through. Lloyd appeared behind him suddenly, just as he was admitting to himself he'd made a stupid move. His superior's proximity made him jump a little. This entire operation made him jumpy.
Regal heard on the radio. We've got him?
A watcher on Boulevard Saint-Germain, a first-rate veteran, spotted him at a choke point. It was a low-probability sighting, to tell you the truth. Can't tell from his known associates list where the hell he's going.
We aren't going to lose him, are we?
I'm sending a couple more watchers into the area. Not too many. The gray man would surely spot anyone who isn't top flight.
Understood. Which kill team are you sending to go after him?
The tech hesitated, cringed. Surely Lloyd would be furious when he learned they all were on their way. But before the tech could answer, Lloyd said,
"Fuck it. This ends now. Send every goddamned gun you have after this bastard. Who gives a shit if it gets messy? We've got to get his ass right there."
The tech breathed a sigh of relief that deflated his lungs.
"Yes, sir."
The Botswanans and the Kazakhs were closest. They ran from different ends of the Latin Quarter, arms down by their sides to keep their coats from flapping open as they jogged and revealing their weapons, their eyes fixed to the next obstacle in front of them, and ears tuned to the radio headsets in their ears. The tech relayed the last known whereabouts of the target. He was out of the initial watcher's field of view now, but pavement artists were moving closer, and their intel would be relayed. The Botswanans, five men, each carried sidearms, caliber 32, a relatively weak bullet, but they augmented their marginal firepower with their tactics. These men were trained to execute three-round strings of fire called a Mozambique drill, a pair of rapid shots to the chest, and then a third, coup de grâce, to the forehead. The term and the tactic came from fighting in Mozambique, when a Rhodesian soldier found his small-caliber handgun had trouble downing an African with shots only to the chest, so he added a headshot for added effect. The four Kazakhs wore small Ingram machine pistols with folding wire stocks under their winter coats. Their running stood out to a policeman, and he called out to them as they sprinted across the street. He took them for foreigners up to no good and made a few hand motions to tell them to slow down. One member of each kill squad also carried a digital video camera attached via Bluetooth connection to their mobile phones. This way they could prove to those at the command center that they were the unit responsible for the termination of the subject and the team who warranted the top prize. This was, after all, still a contest. Each team knew from their earpieces that the other was approaching the last known whereabouts of the target from the opposite direction. This rushed them as much as the need to close on the target before he disappeared. This was more than a hunt. It was a competition, and to these teams, professional pride meant as much to them as did winning the money.
"All elements, this is the tech. We have two watchers 3 blocks east of the last target sighting. Neither watcher has reported any signs of the target. He may have stepped into a hotel or cafe on the street, turned south into the Latin Quarter, or north towards Pont Neuf to cross the river.
Both teams, closing from opposite directions, slowed and conferred after getting this last intel from the tech. Then both teams continued on. The Botswanans ran east on the Saint-Germain, the Kazakhs west on the Saint-Germain. They spread out to cover both sides of the street in groups of 2 or 3, each small team of hunters looking in doorways, alleyways, cafes, and hotels along the way. Song Park Kim ran along the roofs of the buildings, got ahead of his quarry's last sighting. His earpiece came to life. From the distinctive beeps, the Korean could tell the transmission was not open to the other teams and watchers. He was the only one receiving.
Tech to Banshee 1, do you read?
I read.
Find a way down to street level, and I will guide you to him. He'll ID the other teams and the watchers and try to get away. They will force him to flee, and he won't be expecting a single assassin. I'll put you in position to stop him.
Yes.
Kim stepped over the edge of a 6-story apartment building's roof, fluidly found footing on a windowsill, lowered himself down, reached across to a drainpipe, and swung his legs over. The pipe was poorly attached to the wall, so he used it only to make his way to a fire escape, followed it down, and dropped the final few feet to the ground, 6 floors of descent in under a minute.
Banshee 1 is on the street, Tech. Guide me to the target. There are 2 teams closer than you, Banshee 1. We think he's turned on to the Rue de Bussy, sticking with the crowds for security. You can move 2 blocks north and be in position to cut him off if they don't spot him.
Yes, said Kim,
but he had no intention of following this direction. The Korean felt he could read the gray man's thoughts. Kim had been hunted many times, and from this experience, he felt he could divine this hunted man's every move. If teams of foreign agents were following him through central Paris on a Saturday night, Kim would notice, and so would the gray man. If dozens of static watchers were placed in his path, Kim would be immediately aware of it, and so would the gray man. He might not identify every single adversary, but the tech had thrown so many bodies into the operation, it would have to be obvious to an operator as skilled as the gray man that he was facing a full-on wet operation, that all the stops had been pulled, and all normal rules of engagement and restraint were out the window. There would be no safety in a crowd. The gunmen that the gray man surely had spotted by now were going to take the first opportunity to destroy their target, and bright lights and passer-by would be more hindrance than security blanket to the hunted man. Yes, Kim could feel what the gray man was feeling just now, and he allowed this symbiosis to guide him, not the directives of the tech. This melding of the minds between Kim, the hunter of the gray man, and the hunted, steered the Korean assassin through the misty night, 3 blocks to the east, to a darkened alleyway just a half block off the noise and lights and swarms of diners and revelers. He knew the River Seine was just 100 meters to the north, meaning if the gray man detected the heavy surveillance, he would need to turn south to melt into the night. The north would afford him nothing but a bridge or two, natural choke points that he would avoid at all costs. Song Park Kim found the darkest spot in the little alleyway, 25 meters north of the Boulevard Saint-Germain and 20 meters south of the Rue de Bussy. He could move off in either direction in seconds if the watchers spotted the target nearby. But Kim had a feeling this little alley would be the site of his final confrontation with his adversary. There were restaurants and nightclubs brimming with patrons just yards from his darkened hiding place. Plus, there were competing kill teams close by. He did not want to draw attention to his act by using a firearm, so he left the MP7 in the backpack on his shoulders. Instead, he pulled his folding knife from his front pocket, flicked open the matte black blade, and tucked his body deeper into the dark to await his prey. Court Gentry felt his black suit moistening from the sweat running down his back as he walked east on the Rue de Bussy. In his right hand, his umbrella swung by his side with each step. He fought the urge to use it as a cane because his feet were hurting from the lacerations he'd picked up in Budapest the day before. But it wasn't the walk that caused him to sweat. It was the eyes scanning the street in front of him, 30 yards distant, he saw a young couple huddled together on a bench, talking to one another but actively checking the male passers-by.
Court had found a bald-headed man about his own age to follow behind. He kept his eyes ahead of the man to see if he was garnering attention that seemed out of place. This would indicate to Gentry he'd been spotted and identified via radio or other surveillance teams in the area. Immediately, the young lovers fixed on the bald man for a few seconds. One seemed to speak to the other about the man, and then their eyes moved on, satisfied he was not the subject of their surveillance. Court knew immediately he had been compromised. He'd seen at least 10 watchers so far, and was reasonably sure he'd slipped every one of them. But there must have been someone he missed, some asset static in a dark window or a car on the street somewhere Gentry could not get a fix on him. And this asset had broadcast Court's appearance and direction to every watcher and hunter in the city. Quickly, Court chanced a glance back over his shoulder. 3 dark-skinned men were moving quickly, looking in a shop window, not 20 meters behind. Across the street, there were 2 more. These guys were part of the same squad, and they were scanning the north side of the street, looking over tables of diners in front of a cafe. Shit. Court turned left down a little passageway off the Rue de l'Ancienne Comédie and followed it in the dark. At its end was dim light from a quiet passage 20 yards on. The watchers would be sparse off the main drag of the left bank as long as they didn't know he'd spotted the surveillance on him. Court walked into the dark, his eyes on the light ahead, the tip of his umbrella scuffing the wet cobblestones. The noise echoed in the black, covered passageway. Court needed to catch a cab back to the Gare Saint-Lazare, pick up his Mercedes, and head on to Bayeux. This stop in Paris, like the stop in Budapest yesterday afternoon and the one in Guarda last night, had been all but useless. At least this time he had gotten away without being hurt, and that was something, though he really needed more help before. From the close dark, there was a flash of movement. Quickly from his left came a figure of a man. Before Court's lightning reflexes could react, he sensed further movement low, an arm swinging towards him. Gentry moved his own right arm to parry it, but he was too slow. He was never too slow. Court Gentry felt the knife stab into his belly and shear through soft flesh just above his left hip bone.
Chapter 29.
At 2 a.m., a shaft of light poured into the blackened second-floor bedroom. Sir Donald lay awake. The rest of the family had been moved into his room so that they could all be watched over by just one guard. Claire slept fitfully on her grandfather's left. Kate snored on his right. Elise was so medicated, it was hard to tell if she was with it or not. She lay sprawled across a chair and ottoman on the other side of the room. Donald saw the silhouette of the Scottish guard, the one named McSpadden. He figured he was in for a covert beating and wondered if he could take much more. McSpadden walked up to the bed, ignored the little girls, and whispered to Fitzroy.
"I'll do you a deal, old man. Here is a phone. Snuck it out of one of the Ivan's kit bags. They're all at battle stations now. I'm the only one on the floor."
"Bugger off. I'm trying to sleep," said Fitzroy.
"Plenty of time for that come the morning, if you're did."
"You don't think I can smell a trap? Why would a tosser like you just hand me a bloody phone?"
Because I want some consideration when this is through."
Fitzroy cocked his corpulent head and pressed it deeper into the pillow to focus on the man standing above him.
"What sort of consideration?"
"The Grey Man. Heard he did Kiev. If he did Kiev, and he did half the other ups they say he did. If he did the team in Prague and Budapest, and the teams in Switzerland. Hell, he just might make it here. He makes it here, and my gun's going in the dirt. I'm doing a runner. I'm not fighting it out with that cold bastard. Got a couple of things to live for, I do. You understand me? Yeah. He shows up, and I'm doing a runner. And I don't want Donald Bleeding Fitzroy or his crazy attack dog coming after me, you see?"
The Scot held out the phone to Fitzroy, and he took it.
"On the level?" asked Fitzroy.
"You're probably dead as dust come the morning, Sir Donald.
I'm not sticking my neck out too far. But if you do make it, remember Ewan McSpadden was the one who helped you.
I'll do that, Ewan.
Call your dog. Tell him if he makes it. I'm the bloke with the green shirt and the black trousers. My gun will be in the dirt. He needn't worry about that.
Good lad, McSpadden.
The Scot receded into the dark. The shaft of light reappeared and then narrowed and extinguished behind him. The knife dug deeper into Gentry's stomach. The pain was horrific. Knee weakening, bowel loosening. Something was happening that Gentry didn't understand. So he looked down, saw he'd somehow caught the attacker's wrist with the hook of the umbrella. Gentry pulled down and away on the umbrella's shaft, did not have the strength to pull the knife out of his body, but at least his effort kept the blade from sinking in more than a couple of inches. Painful, excruciatingly painful, but much better than the knife digging in hilt deep or worse, cutting up into his gut like a fish filleted. With all his might, Court pulled down on the umbrella with his right hand. With his left, he reached out at the attacker. He fisted him in the chest weakly, because there was little strength in reserve after the exertion from his right arm and the pain deep in his belly. The assassin punched back, tried a headbutt, but Court leaned away from it in time. Court reached across his body to his waistband, took poor hold of the Glock pistol with his left hand, but drew it anyway, just pulled it free of his belt as the assassin knocked it away. The steel and polymer weapon clanged to the cobblestones, rattled off in the dark. Their free hands fought one another, the attacker in the dark warding off an attempted eye gouge, and Gentry deflecting an open-handed blow to his Adam's apple that would have surely killed him, the tempered steel shaft stabbing into him notwithstanding. The attacker gave up on trying to yank the knife up to the sternum or push it in deeper. The umbrella's hook on his arm prevented him from accomplishing either task. Instead, the blade cut down, came to rest against the hip bone and gouged into it. Gentry stifled a scream. He was nearly out of his mind from pain, but knew more killers were yards away. Any slim chance he had at survival against the blade in him and the man manipulating it would disappear if more men intent on his demise heard his cries. Court changed tactics himself. He pushed forward with his legs and shoved his chest into the smaller man, an Asian he could clearly now see. He slammed him into the wall, which only served to jab the knife in him a fraction of an inch deeper. Court followed this with a headbutt that slammed the two men's foreheads together with a crack louder than any other sound in the alleyway since the fight began. The umbrella still held the Asian's right hand down. Court pushed again with his body, and the Asian stumbled backwards all the way across the alley and slammed into the other wall. Court was still attached by the knife's blade, so he moved along with his attacker. The light was better over here, and, through the agony that threatened to cloud his mind to mush, Court saw the straps of the backpack and realized the man was now trying to take hold of something behind him in the bag with his free hand. Court grabbed the Korean's wrist with his own free hand and slammed it back into the brick wall.
"What you got?"
Court asked, his voice quavering with pain and exertion.
"What's in the bag?"
There was enough light for eye contact on this side of the covered alley, and their eye contact did not waver, though both men's lids twitched with the expenditure of effort. One pushed forward, the other pushed back.
"What's in the bag?"
Gentry yanked sideways with the umbrella, pulled the Asian quickly off balance, used the moment to reach behind the man to the pack pressed against the wall. The American had to tighten his abdominals to do so, and his voice cracked as he groaned in agony. The Asian turned the knife. The 2-inch-deep wound opened with the twist, and Gentry felt blood run freely across his crotch and down the insides of both legs. It was quieter than a scream, but it echoed in the alleyway nonetheless. Court had the bag now and got a hand on a zipper. Kim knocked the hand away with the side of his head. Another headbutt from Gentry stunned the assassin, and Court quickly opened the top of the backpack and reached inside with his left hand.
"What's this? What's this?"
he asked as tears began streaming down his face. The tears dripped into the spit that sprayed from his sobbing mouth as he spoke. The discharge flew into his attacker's face with his words.
"This what you want? This what you're after, huh?"
Court pulled the end of a small black subgun from the bag, stared into the new fear in the eyes of his adversary.
Kim reached back and got his hand around the squat suppressor of the weapon, then pushed harder on the knife hilt. Court tried to back off of the blade, but could not, and the shaft sank another millimeter into his gut. Court slid his finger into the trigger guard and fired the MP7. Kim had left the fire selector switch on semi-auto, just as Gentry would have. The barrel was pointed at the brick wall behind Kim, and the rounds exploded off the masonry and debris whizzed around them both. As fast as he could, Gentry pulled the trigger. Each ignition of a cartridge in the breech caused recoil, which made Court's body jerk, which allowed the knife in his gut to bite into a new morsel of flesh and bone. 3 rounds, 5 rounds, 10 rounds, 20 rounds. Kim screamed in agony and let go of the weapon silencer, nearly white-hot now from the gunfire. He wrapped his burned hand around the hand that held the knife, and now with both clenched fists and all his might, he tried to force one last, fast, massive thrust of the blade through to the gray man's spine. The American's blood pumped over his scorched fingers. Gentry brought the empty HK down in one quick action, smashed the hot barrel into Kim's face, breaking his nose. Both men fell to the cobblestones, their connection finally broken. Kim lay on his back, head against the bullet-pocked wall, blood gushing out his nose, and his burned hand cradled in his lap. His chest heaved from exertion. Gentry lay on his side in the center of the alley, his chest also heaving, the black hilt of the black knife jutting obscenely from his lower abdomen. Court tried to pull the knife free, cried out as he did so. The Asian, exhausted and stunned from the concussion, clambered to his knees and frantically crawled across the cold stones to close the distance between them. At 5 feet, he leapt into the air, desperate to get his hand on the knife before the gray man pulled it out of his stomach. An instant before he landed on his target, the full length of the black knife's blade appeared in the low light, slick, wet with blood. Court slashed it backhanded across the wide-eyed Asian's throat as he came down. Arterial blood spewed forth. Song Park Kim thrashed in the alleyway and died in seconds, his lower torso ending up across the gray man's body. Gentry dropped the knife on the cobblestones and pushed the dead man's still spasming legs off him. The body rolled unceremoniously onto its back, and all movement ceased. Court unfastened his tie with one hand and wadded it into a ball. He took a couple of deep breaths to steady himself, and then pressed the ball down into the hole in his abdomen. Blood ran down his white shirt onto the pavement.
"Jesus!"
he screamed, tears and spit and snot covering a face contorted with pain. He felt the nausea brought on by abject agony, but quelled it by focusing on his work. Normally he was careful about his DNA, but now he didn't bother. It would take a bathtub of bleach, a 5-man cleaning crew, and a full day to sanitize this scene, and Court had nothing of the sort. The pressure of the wadded necktie actually reduced the pain when he flexed his abs. Without it, he would not have been able to stand. But he did stand, stumbled, steadied himself on the alley's wall, and shuffled on. He heard voices behind him. Passers-by had been alerted by the noise of the scuffle. Police and killers would be here in seconds. He stumbled around the corner to a shopping passage. The stores were closed for the night, and there were no window shoppers. With his body slumped over, his face white, he staggered away from the orgy of blood behind him. He moved north off into the cold night, his life's blood draining down his leg and dripping onto the paving stones at his feet. 30 seconds later, one of the Botswanans shoved his way through a panicking crowd and found the Korean's body. The dark alley, a blood-dripping horror show, in the beam of light from the African assassin's tactical flashlight. He called it into the tech.
"There is a dead man here. He is Asian, nearly decapitated."
Lloyd and Regal stood behind the tech as the Botswanan assassin's accented English came over the speakers. Mr. Felix entered the room, stood back in the shadows, and watched intently. The tech flipped a switch on his bank of electronics in front of him.
"Banshee 1, do you read? Banshee 1, how do you copy?"
There was a shuffling sound on the speaker. Lloyd and Regal looked up in hope.
"He can't come to the phone right now. Don't bother to leave a message,"
said a mocking African voice. The Botswanan had obviously pulled the radio set off the dead Korean and was speaking into it. Regal said,
"The Korean was probably the best man we had on this job. His organization is going to be furious he was lost on this operation."
"Fuck 'em," snapped Lloyd. "They should have sent us someone who could complete the task. When they gave us only one man, I knew their heart wasn't in this game."
"You are an idiot, Lloyd. Do you have any idea what that assassin has done in his career?"
"Sure do. He left a greasy stain in a Paris alleyway. The rest I couldn't give a flying fuck about." Just then, the Botswanan hunter came back over the speakers.
"There is a blood trail leading north. We'll follow it. We'll find him."
"You see," said Regal. "Banshee One served his purpose."
3 minutes later, a watcher came over the net.
54 to tick. Go ahead, 54. I'm in a fourth floor window near the Place Saint-Michel. I believe I am tracking the subject on my camera. I can send it to you for verification.
It took 10 seconds to make the connection. When the plasma monitor in the control room sparked to life, the lights of Paris shone brightly, silhouetting the Notre Dame Cathedral. The Seine was a glimmering ribbon bisecting the city. The camera did not seem to be centered on anything in particular.
"Where is he?"
shouted Regal, the hunter, wild from the chase now, frantically searching for his quarry.
54, tighten up on the subject.
Oui, monsieur.
The image zoomed to the Pont Neuf bridge that ran over the river to the cathedral. A lone figure in a dark suit hobbled, stumbled, stopped, and stooped in the middle of the bridge. Clearly the man was wounded, fleeing, trying to cross from the left bank to the Île de Cité, the tiny island in the middle of the Seine upon which the Cathedral of Notre Dame stands.
"Look at him! He's toast!" shouted Lloyd with excitement. "Who do we have close by?"
The tech answered before Lloyd finished posing the question.
"The Kazakhs are 30 seconds out. You'll see them coming up the bridge from the south. The Botswanans are close behind them, and the Bolivians are to the north of the Seine. The Sri Lankans are still 10 minutes west."
The video image widened enough to see the buildings on the Quai de Grands Augustines, the left bank road that rimmed the Seine. Several men sprinted along the road and turned right onto the bridge. One of them slipped on the wet cobblestones and fell, but the others held their footing and raced up the incline of the Pont Neuf.
"This is it," Regal proclaimed victoriously. "Tell them to finish him, get the body into a car, and on the way to the heliport. We'll have it ferried here for Mr. Felix to see up close."
"That would be satisfactory, Mr. Regal. Thank you,"
said Felix, standing like a statue behind the animated men in front of the bank of monitors. The watcher's camera tightened back in on Gentry. He'd turned around and was facing the Kazakhs, who were not more than 40 yards away now. The injured American stood upright, though it obviously pained him to do so. He looked back over his shoulder to the other end of the bridge. Lloyd said,
"You won't make it, Court. You can't run anymore. You are so fucked."
There was mirth in his voice. But Regal muttered,
"Shit."
"What's wrong?" asked Lloyd.
"Scheiße,"
Regal repeated himself in German.
"What's wrong with you? We've got him."
Just then, the gray man stepped to the cement railing. He looked back up to the men closing on him, 25 yards off.
"No,"
said Lloyd, understanding Regal's worry.
"No, no, no, no!"
Kurt Regal pulled the microphone off the tech's table, jammed the button down, and shouted,
"Schießt ihn sofort!"
He caught himself speaking German in his excitement. He screamed,
"Shoot him now!"
But it was too late. Court Gentry tipped himself over the railing, fell 30 feet to the shimmering water, its crystalline surface exploding as his body crashed through it, his dark form disappearing as the current reformed into a swiftly flowing mirror. Lloyd spun away from the monitor. He put his hands on his head in shock. Then he turned to Felix, who remained silently behind.
"You saw that! You saw him! He's dead!"
"Falling into water does not kill a man, my friend. I'm sorry. I need confirmation for my president."
Lloyd turned back to the tech and screamed loud enough to be heard all over the chateau.
God damn it! Tell them to get their asses in the water! We need his corpse!
The image on the plasma screen showed the Kazakhs converging on the portion of the Pont Neuf just vacated by the target not 5 seconds earlier.
They all looked over the side. 5 men were on the bridge. 2 jumped over the railing and dropped into the cold, black water, while 3 ran back to the left bank. Regal belted out instructions to the tech.
He's injured badly, and that fall didn't help him. Get the Botswanans there. Move the Bolivians and the Sri Lankans, too. Put somebody in a boat in case his body doesn't wash up immediately. Brief everyone to search both banks. Move all the watchers downstream to hunt for where he washes up. We need his body, and we need it now!
Chapter 30 At 2:30, a soft rain began to fall. 500 yards east-southeast of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, on the left bank of the Seine, the Jardin Tino Rossi was barren in the dark. 50 feet from the cobblestone quay, a grassy embankment ran along next to a low stone wall. There, between a tree and the wall, a figure lay on its back, knees raised slightly and arms askew. Anyone who walked up to the waterlogged body would see it had obviously come from the river. Perhaps a defiant, final jolt of strength had allowed its weak arms to crawl clear of the river's edge into the soft, wet grass. Maybe it even found its feet for a moment. But then those arms and legs must have given out wholly, and the body had collapsed on the cold ground. There was no movement at all from the body, no sound either, until an electronic noise began peeping, muffled by soaked clothing. The body did not stir at once. Finally, a twitch in the shoulders, a slight turn of the head in new recognition of its surroundings. After another ring, the form slowly reached into a coat pocket, pulled out a plastic case, and fumbled with it with one hand. It popped open, and the satellite phone dropped into the grass. The body's eyes remained on the sky. After jumping from the bridge, Gentry had hit the water hard. The cold took away what breath remained in his lungs after the impact. He sank deep. When he found the surface, he had already been carried downstream, under the Pont Neuf, and towards the west. He sucked air and water as he bobbed for a minute or so before seeing a small house barge churning upstream towards him. Though Court was weak, on the verge of losing consciousness, he hooked an arm around the bottom rung of a ladder hanging off the side of the slow-moving black boat as it passed him. He held on with one hand, kept his head low in the boat's foamy wake, as the craft towed him back under the bridge from which he had just fallen. He heard the shouts of men in the water around him as they dove down, looking for a body, or train their flashlights around the spans of the bridge. 10 minutes later, Court was free of immediate detection. With nearly his last ounce of strength, he tried to climb the ladder to get on board the boat, but he fell. His weak legs, the pain in his gut, his wet shoes, the numbing cold, all worked against him, and he dropped back into the frigid current. He reached out for the barge, took nothing but a fistful of the river, while the black ship chugged away upstream. Fortunately for Gentry, he was not far from the water's edge. He made it to the left bank, struggled up onto the pavement, climbed to his feet, but fell again in the wet grass next to a tree in the Jardin Tino Rossi. And here he lay for 20 minutes, eyes open but unfixed, the soft drops of rain falling and beating and exploding against his pupils. The phone rang again, and he lifted it off the grass, his eyes still on the impossibly low rain clouds illuminated by city lights around him. His voice was weak and distant.
Yeah.
Good evening. This is Claire Fitzroy calling. May I please speak with Mr. Jim?
Gentry blinked away the rain. His eyes instead filled with tears. He controlled his voice as best as possible, did what he could to mask the pain and the exhaustion and the despair and the utter sense of failure.
It's past your bedtime.
Yes, sir, but Grandpa Donald said I could call you.
You remember me?
Oh, yes, sir. I remember how you drove us to school, slept on the little cot in the hall, but Mommy said you didn't really sleep. You watched out for us all night. You drank coffee, and you liked my mommy's eggs.
That's right. Extra cheese.
Cort's pelvic bone had been gored, his abdominal wall punctured. He did not think the knife made it deep enough to slice through his intestines, but the pain burning into the center of his being was indescribable, nonetheless. He assumed he was still bleeding. He'd done nothing to stanch the flow since he'd dropped into the river nearly an hour earlier. The sirens of emergency vehicles screeched past on Gentry's right. He was hidden from their view by the stone wall and the darkness.
Mr. Jim, Grandpa Donald said you are coming to save us.
Tears streamed down the American's face. He wasn't dead, but this felt a lot like dying. He knew he could not make it to Bayou, and even if he somehow could, what could he do but bleed to death on the castle's doorstep?
Where is your grandfather?
He's in the bedroom. He can't walk right now. He said he fell down the stairs, but that is not true. The men here hurt him. He gave me the phone and told me to go into the bathroom closet and call you.
She paused.
That's why I have to whisper. You are coming, right? Please tell me you are coming. If you don't come, you are our only chance since Daddy's gone to London. Mr. Jim, are you there?
Typical of Fitzroy. If Sir Donald himself had made this call, Cort would have told him all was lost. But the cagey bastard had known Gentry would be in dire straits right about now, so who better to entice him to keep up the fight than one of the twins?
I'll do my best.
Do you promise?
Cort lay there in the dark, his freezing, soaked suit askew on his body, the cold mud pressed into the back of his neck and his shaved head. Slowly, with a weak voice, he said,
I'll be there very soon.
Do you promise?
Cort looked down at the wound in his belly. He pressed hard upon it now.
I promise, he said, and he seemed to muster a little power in his voice. And when I get there, I need you to promise you will do something for me.
Yes, sir?
When you hear a lot of noise, I want you to go to your room, crawl under your bed, and stay there. Can you do that for me?
Noise? What kind of noise? Do you mean guns?
I do mean guns.
Okay.
Stay there until I come to get you. Get your sister to do the same, okay?
Thank you, Jim. I just knew you would come.
Claire,
there was a shred of new strength in Gentry's voice now.
I need you to sneak the phone back to your grandfather. I have to ask him a very important question.
All right, Jim.
And Claire, thank you for calling. It was nice to hear from you.
16 minutes later, Gentry staggered along the Rue du Cardinal Lemoine. The rain had picked up, and there was no one around, which was lucky for the gray man, because he walked with both hands pressed to the left side of his abdomen, his left leg ramrod straight as he kicked it forward. Every 25 yards or so he stopped, leaned against a wall or a car or a lamppost, bent forward from pain, recovered after a few seconds to push off and cover a few more steps before again seeking refuge from the exhaustion of the blood loss. He found the address Fitzroy gave him. The door was closed and bolted as he knew it would be, so he found a dark alcove a few doorways down and tucked into it, sat on a piece of cardboard like a bum, and leaned his head on the stoop to rest. Sing-song police sirens wailed in the distance, maybe a mile away now.
Surely the cops and the hitters and the watchers were all along the Seine looking for him, though hopefully they were concentrating their search not upstream but down, and hopefully they were all hindering one another with their respective presence. He was just on the verge of dozing, his fist pressed into his bloody stomach, when he heard a noise back by the address Fitzroy gave him. He peered out of the alcove and saw the locked door open slowly. He'd expected someone to come by car, but apparently whoever worked at the location lived in a flat above in the same building. A woman appeared on the pavement, barely visible from a street lamp 20 meters on. Court rose to his feet and staggered forward.
"Allez!"
she shouted in a whisper.
"Hurry!"
He passed her, staggering still, and found himself in a long hall. Steadying his weak and swaying body on the corridor's walls, he saw immediately he was smearing his own blood with his hands as he walked. The woman quickly tucked her head under his arm and hefted him. She was tall and thin, but strong. After each step, he felt himself giving in to her more and more. They went through a doorway and into a darkened room. Before she could flip on the light, encumbered by the 170-pound man, Court was startled by a barking dog close, then another, then 10 or more dogs barking at once all around him. When the bright overhead snapped on, he realized immediately that the emergency clinic Donald had sent him to was, in actuality, a veterinarian's office. His knees gave out, and his weight dropped on the girl by his side. With a boyish grunt, she pushed him forward and down to a small chair.
"Parlez-vous français?"
she asked, looking down to him. He looked up and saw, apropos of nothing, that she was rather pretty.
"Parlez-vous anglais?" he asked.
"Yes, Sam. You are English?"
"Yeah,"
he lied, but he had no intention of trying to fake an accent.
"Monsieur, I tried to tell Monsieur Fitzroy. The doctor is out of town, but I called him. He is on his way here now. He will arrive in a few hours. I am sorry. I did not know how badly you were hurt. I cannot help you. I will call an ambulance. You need a hospital."
"No. You are in Fitzroy's network. You at least have medicine and blood and bandages."
"Not here. I am sorry. Dr. Le Pen has access to a clinic nearby, but I do not. I only work here with the animals. You need a hospital. You need emergency aid. Mon Dieu, you are cold. I will find you a blanket."
She turned from him and left the room, returned with a thick wool blanket that smelled like cat piss. She draped it over his shoulders.
"What is your name?"
Court asked, his voice at its weakest point yet.
"Justine."
"Look, Justine, you're a vet. That's close enough. I just need some blood and..."
"I am a veterinary's assistant."
"Well, that's close to close enough. We can make this work. Please, help me."
"I give baths. I hold the dogs down for the doctor. I can't help you. The doctor is on his way. But you cannot wait for him. You are completely white. You need blood, fluids."
"I don't have time to wait. Look, I know battlefield medicine. I can talk you through what I need. We'll have to get some blood, just a couple of units of O positive, some antibiotics, and your hands. When the weakness and pain get to be too much, I won't be able to do what needs to be done."
"Battlefield medicine? This is no battlefield. This is Paris."
Court grunted.
"Tell that to the guy who did this."
He opened the blanket and took his hand from his knife wound. His blood pressure was low enough now to where the blood no longer pumped from his waist, but it oozed and glistened in the harsh light of the treatment room. Justine gasped.
"That looks bad."
"Could be worse. It's through the muscle, bloody, but I'll be okay if I can get some O positive. If you can help me, I'll be on my way. Fitzroy will pay you and your doctor for the trouble."
"Monsieur, are you not listening? I work with the dogs."
He shut his eyes, seemed to drift off a bit, but he said,
"Just picture me with fur."
"How can you joke? You are bleeding to death."
"Only because we're arguing. Where is this clinic? We can go there, get what I need. I can't go to a hospital. Have to do it this way.
She breathed out a long sigh, nodded, and tied her brown hair in a ponytail behind her head.
Let me put a bandage on that so you do not lose more blood.
The barking of the dogs began to subside. The small surgical center in the vet's office was filthy. It had not been well cleaned after the close of business on Friday.
I am sorry, monsieur. If I knew you were coming...
It's fine.
Court made to pull himself onto the metal stand in the middle of the room, but Justine stopped him, grabbed a spray bottle, and perfunctorily wet and wiped down the brushed aluminum surface while her patient leaned against a shelf of bandages. She ran out through the door and came back with a cushion from the sofa in the waiting room.
You must let your legs hang off the side. It is not made for persons.
Okay.
He used his last bit of strength to rip open his shirt. Buttons flew and bounced over the tiled room. Justine pulled off his rain-soaked shoes and used shears to cut his pants off, left him in his shorts.
I am not so experienced with humans, she said.
You're doing great.
She fought her timidity and looked Gentry over from head to toe.
What happened to you?
I got shot in the leg a couple of days back.
With a gun?
She looked down at the open 3-day-old wound in his thigh, then back up to the bloody hip. She quickly pulled rubber gloves on over her small hands.
Mon Dieu!
And then my legs and feet got cut with broken glass.
I see that.
Then I snapped a rib rolling down a mountain in Switzerland.
A mountain?
Yes. Then I fucked up my wrist, busting out of some handcuffs.
Justine was silent. Her jaw had dropped open slightly.
And your stomach?
Knife wound.
Where?
Here in Paris. About an hour ago, I guess. And then I fell into the Seine.
She shook her head.
Monsieur, I do not know what you do for a living, and I do not want to know. But whatever it is, I think you should find some other type of job.
Court laughed a little, setting fire to the stab wound.
My skill set is not conducive to honest work.
I'm sorry. I do not understand these words.
Never mind. Justine, we can stanch the knife wound with this bandage, more or less. But if I don't get some blood in me, I'll pass out.
The clinic is close by, but it is closed.
We're going to open it, Court said. Let's go. I need to be on the move in under an hour.
Justine had been wrapping a compression bandage tight around Court's waist to hold the thick square of gauze she'd placed over the knife wound.
Move? You don't need to move at all, for days. Do you not understand how badly injured you are?
You don't understand. I have some place I have to be. I just have to get patched up so I can leave.
She clenched her teeth, and her eyes widened.
Monsieur, I am no doctor, but I can promise you there is no place you need to be right now other than in medical care. You could die within the hour.
I'll be okay. I have to be.
Justine knelt down, unlocked a low cabinet, and began pulling equipment from it.
That is impossible. If we give you a transfusion, the blood will just leak out of your stomach if you move. You'll need stitches. When you get the stitches, they will just break if you try to move.
Court thought it over. He looked down to his wristwatch to find it was 3 a.m.
I need to get to Bayeux, up in Normandy.
Tonight? Are you crazy?
It's life or death, Justine.
Yes, your death, monsieur.
Court pulled Maurice's envelope of cash from his pocket. It was soaked, but it was a miracle it had survived the river, as had his car keys. He handed the soggy envelope to Justine.
How much is it?
He asked as she looked through it. Her eyes returned to his.
It's a lot.
It's all yours. Just help me get to Bayeux before 8 a.m.
If you can't even drive a car, what do you expect to do when you get there?
I can drive the car, but I need you to stitch me up and bandage me while I drive. We can do the transfusion on the way.
She stood slowly, said each word alone.
Sutures. In. The car.
Court nodded.
"Well, you drive the car?"
"Yes." She muttered something in French that Court did not understand. He picked up the word for dogs and figured she was saying it was due to moments like these that she preferred her patients to be the four-legged variety. She tied the bandages around his waist and helped him put his wet dress shirt back over his shoulders. She did not look up from her work as she spoke.
"What is going on in Bayou early on Sunday morning that you absolutely cannot miss?"
"Would you believe me if I told you I was singing in the church choir?" She shook her head without smiling.
"No."
"Okay, then I will tell you." And he told her. He told her with holes in his story jumbo jets could fly through about what had happened and what he had to do by 8 a.m. He told her about the kidnapped girls and the father who died trying to protect them. He told her about the teams of foreign operatives after him, and, as the blood loss and fatigue addled his brain, he told her again about the phone call from Claire, and again about the little kids he just had to protect. She reacted with horror when he talked of the killers and the killing, the mortal peril of two little girls for the sake of the reputation of some thuggish corporation. Yes, Justine worked for a doctor of veterinary medicine who occasionally kept some strange hours and dealt with some highly suspicious patients, and the doctor had told her enough about Fitzroy and the network to where she knew to ask no further questions. But she never imagined in a million years that men were as brutal and as callous as those in the stranger's story.
"So, what do you think?" asked Court.
"Why are you trusting me?"
"Desperation. I was dead on the riverbank 45 minutes ago. Since that moment, you've become my only hope. If you double-cross me, I am no worse off than I was lying there."
"What about the police?"
"Lloyd says he will kill the hostages if anyone but me shows up at the house. I know men like this. They will do exactly what they threaten to do. I have to go alone, with your help. I'll leave you in Bayou. My destination is a few kilometers north of the village. You can be on the morning's first train back to Paris. You'll be miles from any danger, I promise you."
"What do I call you?"
she asked. "Jim."
"Okay, Jim. We will go on one condition."
"What's that?"
"Let me give you a little pain medicine, just for the procedure. We'll find something at the clinic that we can give you once the transfusion brings your blood pressure back up. We will take my car. I will drive to Gare Saint-Lazare to get your car. Then we can go. There will be no traffic on the road once we leave town. I will work on your injury as you drive."
Court thought about it. Every fiber of his being was against taking any medication that would cloud his mind and dull his senses, leave him less than completely focused on the task at hand. He felt he could handle the pain. No, he did not like Justine's plan, but for some reason, he did trust her. And as he looked at the cute, gangly girl standing over him, still pretty with her ponytailed hair messy from her bed and no makeup on her face, and sweat forming above her lip from the work she was doing to keep some scary stranger alive, he conceded he was in absolutely no position to argue. Justine helped Court back to his feet, and the two of them staggered together slowly out of the treatment room and down the hall towards the back of the clinic. Gentry winced with each step. Once his head bobbed low as if he would pass out. Justine propped him against the wall in the courtyard while she fumbled with her keys.
"What the hell is this?"
Gentry asked.
"It's my car."
"That's a car."
"What's wrong with it?"
"It's small."
"When I bought it, I didn't know I would be transporting patients in the passenger seat."
"Fair enough. It's fine. It sure as hell won't draw much attention."
They both smiled a little, but the smiles drifted away as she tried to help lower him into the seat. Court cried out in pain, a cry that culminated with shallow panting. It took her nearly a minute to fire the little engine. By then, Court was asleep. She dropped his seat to where he could lie almost flat.
With considerable effort, she was able to get his legs up on the dashboard to help him keep from going into shock. As she turned north on Rue Monge, she saw helicopters in the air in the distance over the river. Justine parked her car a few doors down from the clinic off the Rue des Écoles. At 3:30, there was not a soul around. Court stirred, looked around for a moment, and then asked her for a pen and a piece of paper. She dug through her purse a moment, and then passed him an envelope and a pencil.
"There's another med I need you to find. Should be with the pediatric drugs."
"One of the twins needs medicine?"
"No, it's for me."
He jotted something down and handed the envelope back to Justine. She looked at it.
"Dextrostat? What does it do?"
"It will help. It's very important. Find it."
She shrugged, promised to look for it. Without another word to Court, she climbed out of her tiny Uno and went back to the trunk. Gentry did not, could not, turn around to see what she was doing. A few seconds later, she walked to the glass door of the building and looked quickly in both directions. A tire iron in her right hand crashed through the glass, and she reached through the sharp shards to open the door from the inside. As Court watched, completely helpless, she disappeared into the dark clinic as a piercing alarm filled the street. Even with the impending danger, Court fell asleep again in the car. He awoke with the jolt of the tiny two-door as it lurched forward. In the glow from the street lamps flickering above them as they moved away from the alarm bells, he caught a glimpse of the young woman's face, intensity and determination.
"What did you get?" he asked.
3 units of O positive, 2 bags of dextrose, morphine, Vicodin, transfusion equipment, antiseptics, and a suture kit."
"And?"
"And the medicine you asked about."
"Well done."
"Yes,"
she said with a little smile.
"That was fun."
In the parking garage below the Gare Saint-Lazare, Justine and Court climbed into the big Mercedes. Gentry took the wheel and sat there, woozy and grimacing from agony. Justine began the transfusion of blood and a bag of nutrients as they sat together in the dark and empty garage. She hooked the bags on the dome light above them to keep the drip going, and the supple black leather interior gave way to the French girl's movements as she knelt over Court, poured antiseptic freely on his waist to let it soak into his bandages and his wounds. Justine instructed Court to just lie there and relax, and she left the car. She disappeared from his view while he sat alone and tried to think about the task still at hand. He knew these delays meant he would not make it to the chateau before 6 in the morning. He would have virtually no time to lay up and get a feel for the territory. No. As it now stood, he'd only have time to drive up to the front door and begin his attack if he wanted to do so under cover of darkness. Shit. Court realized his chances for success were never good, but after the stabbing in Paris, they had now become incalculably small. Just then, Justine returned with a bag of pastries and 2 large servings of coffee. Court pulled 1 foam cup from her hand and swigged it until his mouth burned.
"Arrête! Stop!"
she demanded.
"Sip it slowly."
Court took a croissant and ripped into it with abandon. She tried to butter it for him while he ate, but he just took the little pat of butter from her hands and gobbled it down, too. Justine lectured him.
"Your mother would not be proud. Relax. You are getting the fluids and nutrition you need from the IV. Too much food with the morphine, and you will throw up. Drink the coffee slowly. Can you drive?"
"We're about to find out,"
Court said with a look of grim determination, and he backed the Mercedes out of the space, exited the underground garage slowly, and rolled out into the night. They took the A15 north out of the city, and just as Justine had promised, there was virtually no traffic at 4 on a Sunday morning. She cursed loudly when she noticed the blood bag empty just a few minutes out of town. She switched it out with a 2nd full-liter bag and switched out the dextrose just to keep the fluids dripping into the IV at the fastest rate possible. The A13 was the most direct route to Bayeux, but Court avoided it. He knew surveillance could easily be set up on the main route to the chateau. Instead, Court took a series of back roads that would add a 30 minutes or so to his journey. For an hour, they delayed the inevitable. Justine talked about her family and friends and her six cats. Her nervousness was evident to Court from her random conversation. With less than an hour to go till the chateau, Justine grew quiet, carefully injected a tiny dose of morphine into Gentry's IV. If his blood pressure was too low, as it surely had been back at the vet clinic, the morphine could have stopped his heart. But after 2.5 units of blood, she determined a small shot of the strong painkiller was worth the risk, considering what he was about to endure.